Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born.
Water is life. Water we drink, water we play in, water we shed as tears. The subject pops up all the time, even at a breast cancer fundraiser. Former First Lady of Idaho, Patricia Kempthorne, was featured at the Pink Tea fundraising event put on by the hospital last week. During her presentation, she was illustrating Mary Ann Rodmacher's points about good living, one by one reviewing each instruction, starting with live with intention. When Patricia got to walk to the edge, water gushed into the story, however.
I thought, okay, walk to the edge. Well, it means different things for different people. But several years ago, there's a group, and many of you have heard of the group called Dress for Success, where we really help women who have been through some really difficult times, and the stories are amazing. And we said, how could we help raise some money for this? And we decided, you know what we're going to do? We decided to put together a whitewater trip. We call it the Wild and Wacky Women's Whitewater Adventure. And we've done it for 7 years, about the same length as this tea. And we invite women on a Friday to come up to the Payette River, and we float the Cabarton Run, which if you've ever done, it's pretty good. It's twos, threes, and a four, depending on what the river's doing, but pretty much twos or threes. We usually get about 30% who have never been on a whitewater trip before. And for some people, a whitewater trip is really going to the edge. And the other thing that happens is those who have done it before, and I'm one of these, I love it because I can yell and scream and hoot and holler and have a wonderful time and nobody hears me. Even the people sitting next to you when the water's splashing over you and getting you. And I always get the front because nobody wants to be there because I protect everybody behind me. But so to me, that wild and wacky Wild and Wacky Women's Whitewater Adventure really represented that sometimes we make choices to just take that little risk, whatever it is. If it's whitewater for you, if it's something else for somebody else, that you do, you feel so alive when you've just taken that little bit to it. And we do it with 40 other women next to us, and we talk all the way down. And of course, the number one rule is what happens on the river stays on the river.
I get a similar sense of freedom on the river. I've always been drawn to water, to rivers in particular. They're wild and unpredictable at one level, constant in their changing. They can move the mightiest boulders if they choose, but usually they would just rather go around. They go where it's easiest to go, with confidence and acceptance of whatever path lies ahead. They move as I want to move, flexibly, with power. Free to flow, uncontrollable, smooth. That's why I decided to be a river guide. I learned to guide the same year that Andrea Clark Mason did. Andrea read a piece for the First Water Show about learning to be a guide on the same river that I learned to be a guide on. Now, as a writer, she captured the real essence of her experience, which included fresh scars from being dumped by her boyfriend just days before the training started. The river was wild and running extremely high and muddy, and she was the oldest in the group of mostly macho guys at the training. Andrea did her guide training that same year that I did, as I said. Andrea and I never met on the river because Andrea took an earlier course that was usually taken by experienced guides. It was called Swift Water Safety. It's about teaching just how little control you actually have and that you are your own rescuer. Learning the inside scoop, or perhaps just being old enough to know she's not immortal, scared her out of guiding. but a few brief weeks later, I showed up to learn to be a guide. I was returning to Idaho to rebuild my life. Only 9 months before, I had fled this small town, which was the home of my choosing, but in the face of my husband's rage. I escaped intact, but for the first time in my life with no visible means of support. So I went to my sister's house and played housewife for her. Not a good housewife, perhaps, but she appreciated my cooking and home chores and decorating more than any man ever has. But the South, where she lives, where I grew up, doesn't really fit me, and I don't fit there. And the Northwest fills my soul. I decided to return to Idaho with no real job, no place to live, and one new dog. So I created a reason to return. I asked for a job as a river guide. I don't know why he said okay, but the owner of the local day trip operation took a chance on me. Maybe he was looking for diversity. Maybe he wanted to do me a favor because I had worked with his son while he was a student and I was working at the College of Engineering. When you get what you ask for, though, you don't ask why. The job, if you can call it that, occasional weekdays for $75 a day, was my anchor for coming back to Idaho. It gave me a timeline and a chance to do something on my so-called bucket list. I said thanks, filled out the paperwork, and drove back across country to be a river guide. Guide training started on my birthday. I was 44. I was afraid sometimes. I learned to go with that. I knew a lot less than I thought I did. I had to deal with not knowing, not being the expert, with not fitting in and not being liked or valued. I learned to be steadfast in being there for myself. It took a few days. Actually, it took a few extra training trips after the official training ended. But then I knew I was ready. And at 44, I was in control of my life. But never, never in control of the river. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, featuring women's voices and women's stories. Today's theme is water again. And I have four more water stories for you, starting off with some science. The Moscow Pullman area gets its drinking water from aquifers. Aquifers are sometimes described as underground rivers, lakes, or reservoirs. In our region, the water is trapped in clays or other porous material underneath some pretty solid layers of basalt, some ancient lava flows. And these aquifers get recharged or filled up with groundwater as it percolates down. But then we pump it out and we drink it and we use it. And there's a balance to how that all works and whether we pump more than gets put back in. Now, Dr. Allison Beale is with Waters of the West, a University of Idaho program that is looking closely at the aquifers that provide drinking water for the Palouse region. She also teaches environmental science at Washington State University. She presented her aquifer work at the recent Palouse Basin Water Summit, where she explained what is called participatory modeling of the aquifer. It's really a simple and useful concept. She gathered a number of people who are interested in water resources in the area, like environmentalists, politicians, farmers, business people. They talk about their concerns, they ask questions, gather data about the aquifer, and they make a computer model of the system. They tweak it and they test it and they reiterate the process. And the result is interesting. The people side is that everybody learns. Even if in the process, they go in thinking they know everything about their own interest, they learn that others see things from a different angle. Now, the science side is that they can agree that the aquifer holds less water today than it did, and that in all probability it will run dry if we don't change our ways in about 125 to 150 years. So we have time to take action. Allison Beale sat down with me in a not-so-quiet corner of the summit area to talk about what her work means. Thank you, Allison Beale, for spending a minute or two with me.
Well, thank you for inviting.
I was looking at the presentation you just did. You showed a model that presents a rather grim and pretty immediate grim future for us as far as water resource in the aquifer. That's what I saw. I mean, our resource is going to go down pretty quickly.
Well, the projection is 100 to 150 years, which is what the planning horizon of a lot of our entities are planning on. And this is based on very conservative experiential knowledge of all of our scientists. In all likelihood, look like you heard Jim Ozinski say today, it's probably much larger than that. So what we're trying not to portray is that it is that grim. There's also lots that can be done. So if we change our habits, we can grow at the same time that we conserve water and use less.
So simple conservation is probably one of the main key items that, affect the, that model as it's developed so far?
Conservation affects it, yes. So low-flow toilets, changing watering habits do affect it, and actually quite dramatically with when you're looking at a so many years horizon. The other thing that you have to remember is when I'm imposing growth upon this model, if we said double the growth, everything is doubling, so ballparks everything. And we know that when we plan communities that typically all of our uses don't double at the same time. So perhaps residential use would go up. And teasing these things out is extremely difficult. It was one of the things that the group had talked about trying to do initially, is teasing out residential use, commercial use, municipal use. And because we don't have records on this, well, we have some records, but we don't have great, you know, thorough records to be able to tease all these uses out. It gets very difficult. So we chose to just lump things. I think as we go along and develop that, our options are going to expand and make it look less grim. When I started this, I'd heard so many people talking about, you know, this very frightening thing, we're dropping it a year and a foot and a half a year, there is no recharge. And after listening to the hydrogeologists, and I think like Jim Ozinski today, actually portrayed a very optimistic picture of our resource.
Well, it's optimistic, but this is my take on it. I'm looking for you to correct it or add to it, is that it's optimistic because we can change it, but if we do nothing, we still would run out of water at some point.
Well, in theory, yes.
In theory,
at some point, and it's just depending upon when that point is.
Because what I'm getting at in trying to describe that is it well enough accepted that the models are portraying a reality to some extent, so that we might get some action. So that people will be likely to be compelled to change their habits, to conserve.
I think people are compelled, and part of the reason for going through this project is to figure out how to communicate with people so that we can communicate sound science, communicate the unknowns, because there are lots of scientific uncertainties, and communicate to people that there is something that they can do. Just changing your own personal habits can have an effect. You know, leaving water on or off, choosing to water your lawn or not to water your lawn. So I think changing our own habits, we can make a significant difference in our resource. And this is one way of trying to explain the technical parts without using, I think, fearful. I think people should change out of understanding, not because they're frightened. And so this is a way of explaining the science.
Another thing that you just touched on that you had talked about in your talk was how this was a collaboration. This model evolved out of a collaboration of so many different people. Mm-hmm. I mean, different walks of life, at least. I don't know about the quantity, the numbers of people involved. But can you talk about the differences? And it's just bringing together people who have, with an issue like water or any natural resource, you get people who are staunchly on various sides of things.
Right.
And so you probably brought people from very different ends of the spectrum as far as
we did
initial beliefs
right
to a table to talk about their own concerns and needs and everything else. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think the
human interest
side. The way that we actually, and this group I don't think was that fragmented, and I think they all have the same goal in the long run, is to manage our resources in a constructive fashion. So I think at least they had the same sort of goal. But what I think that participatory modeling is so good at doing is it helps people clarify their mental models of the future. What are you basing decisions on? So we had facility operators that are basing their decisions on, you know, with their planning tools on, say, 100 years of water. It's far enough out, it's reasonable, there's something that you can do in the meantime to deal with things. They're also quite aware of how much water they've got in their wells, so they tend to perceive things a little bit differently, whereas a different sort of concern would be, you know, somebody worrying about a rural well going dry because of these big entities pumping, and they were at the table. So we were able actually to discuss these things in the context of the model. Well, if you see this much of a decline, what would that mean to my well? And we didn't have any conflict at all. I think there was some discussion at one point in time, you know, people want to know when we're going to run out of water. And I think that's the wrong question. I think the question is, if you knew, what would you do? So if you knew it was going to be, you know, tomorrow, if you knew it was going to be 50 years from now, if you knew it was going to be 1,000 years from now, what would you do? And as a community, we might do one thing, but we also have to look at our community in the context of the rest of the U.S. West, which we heard a little bit today, and the rest of the country, who a lot of the West is going to be dealing with severe water shortages within the next 10 or 20 years. We're already, you know, as communities preparing for that. We've got a lot of communities that are dealing with serious quality problems and looking at having to get water treatment that can treat out drugs, you know, high nitrogen loads. And so it creates this pressure on our resource. We have this external pressure that I think we're not looking at. And so what I'm trying to do is get people to look beyond. And I did bring up to one of our university people at one of these meetings, well, he says, well, we got 100 years of water. And then my point was, well, that's relative. You need to tell then perhaps capital planning that we're at our half-life if the university's been here for 100 years. And then it's just like, oh, well, that's a different perspective. So if we're going to be a 200-year university, and we're planning that we're going to be done then because our resource is gone, I mean, what's with this picture? So I think it's a lot of it has to do with perspectives. And what I'm trying to do with people is just get them to think in different ways. And we're not actually trying to come to consensus on anything yet. And I think that this process could eventually lead to something like that, lead to a decision support tool, quote unquote, that people who are making decisions can all sit around together. The model's been vetted by community members. It's been used for educational purposes and say, okay, if we want to grow our community in this direction, what are the pros and cons? What are the costs and benefits? If we choose to limit growth, what are the costs? Is it going to raise our property values and have affordable homing for students go away? If we encourage growth, is our resource going to run out sooner? Or can we encourage the right kind of growth and conservation at the same time to balance things out?
Just a second to go back, if we can, to the group. And you said there's no major conflicts. That's nice. Mm-hmm. But they did help each other learn a mm-hmm. lot from those different perspectives. Like you said, whether it was you used the example of the facility operator versus the person with their own well.
Mm-hmm.
Any other examples or stories where they're just totally different perspectives of where people were coming from?
Yeah, I guess so.
There may not be, but I'm just... I'm just curious
think,
because I know I only have my perspective,
right,
which is very limited.
I know it bothered him that he wasn't cast this semester.
I think at this point it's still been sort of very educational and people feeling each other out as far as what they can say. And we've had it very open and the discussions have been, models are good for this in this kind of way because all models are wrong, just some are useful. So when I come back with an iteration of it, they'll, you know, it's, okay, this is what I've sort of come up with. And, you know, there'll be lots of scratching that. And, well, why is this doing this and why is this doing that? So in the process of me then explaining what I thought they explained to me, we can get more information. And they learn from each other in this sense. So we don't have good history from, you know, good well history really from, well, depending on who you talk to, from 1940 before. So we've tried to go with the model and go back to 1900 as a base point, saying we were full then because we were artesian. So that was sort of a random starting point for me to say, okay, if it was full then and we've been drawing And, but the, you know, just anecdotal information, well, we don't know how much we pumped in 1930. Well, we have a guesstimate of population. We have some very old, very, very old records that everybody's quite dubious. But we also had one of our participants that grew up here and remembers, you know, she remembers Artesians.
In the 30s.
Yeah. So it's, you know, these sort of interesting things, or stories of them anyway. I shouldn't be dating her that, but she could be that. But these, you know, these sorts of things help in these contexts and help us learn about assumptions. So I think in that sense, so we have one person who's very non-technical but has this grand historic, you know, perspective, has lived on the land for a long time, has seen stream flows decrease. You know, and why are stream flows decreasing? Well, one would say it probably has to do with pumping of some sort. So if we're pumping like all these surface wells, less is getting into the streams. If less is getting into the streams, is less making it to the aquifer? So all these different sorts of questions that come up from observations actually can be brought into the system and help us understand it better. So these just very different perspectives. So here's a homeowner who's lived on a creek versus a facility operator that has well data. And so we have different perspectives too from Pullman and Moscow. I think they've worked together so much that they're very comfortable working with one another. And the universities, I think, is fairly similar.
To each other?
Yeah, I mean, yes, they've got working relationships and this sort of thing. The other thing, too, I think we're not terribly contentious yet, is nobody is on the spot to make a decision. So until you actually getting pressed to the point you have to say, I'm making a decision based on this, then you don't get into these trade-offs. But hopefully, going through a process like this, people learn that certain things that they thought perhaps were very important to the system, you know, if we have wildly different agreements on a value of a parameter, for instance, we put it on one of these sliders that I showed, and we say, okay, if it's this value, how does the system respond? If it's this value, how does the system respond? If the system responds wildly differently, then we need to investigate why. If it doesn't, can we please stop discussing it?
So you're saying if a certain parameter doesn't affect the system that much, then...
You know, then why are we arguing?
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of times these things become moot points. And in other processes, for example, there was a study done, a similar project to this, that went the full technical route in Las Vegas on their air quality, because they were losing federal highway dollars because their air quality was poor. Well, do they add buses or put in an HOV lane? So they went through with all the engineers, they modeled their emissions, and one guy was just sure from the beginning. HOV lane was the worst way to go about this. And once they ran all the numbers and did the comparisons, he was like, oh, I was wrong, and stopped arguing about it. But he had the science placed in his hand. Instead of some, and he was part of the scientific process that developed it, rather than some expert coming in and saying, HOV lanes are better. And this is where the participatory part of this, I think, is so important, that if you're involved in the progression of this and you understand the assumptions and you understand that science is just science, it's not trying to pull the wool over your heads, and as long as you understand the assumptions that the science is based on, then hopefully people are comfortable with that.
And then with modeling, the assumptions are a big deal, because as you said, every model is inaccurate or wrong.
All models are wrong. Some are useful.
And some are useful. So, yeah.
So we have modeling assumptions, and it's only a portion of reality. And the big ones in this model, we had long discussions about.
How did you get involved in this? How did this start up for you? You're with Waters of the West.
I did my master's. I came back to the area is it 6 years ago now? I can't remember. And started my graduate degree, and my master's in environmental science was on collaborative problem solving. And at the end of my master's career, I took a class in modeling and fell in love with it because it's just logical. And environmental problems are also messy. So it was like my time out was to go build a little model with algebra and, you know, let the model do the calculus, because that hurts your brain. So the model does all the calculus for you. You know, you put in these equations and it runs the hard stuff for you. So, and it does it without code, which is even better, so it's transparent. And I thought, this is really great, and there's got to be a way to integrate these. And about that time, a book came out by a woman named Marjan Vandenbelt called Mediated Modeling, and she'd done some projects to help people scope problems using a modeling venue. And we thought this was very interesting, and a colleague of mine was interested in this as well, and we ended up, at that time, the sage grouse were being slated for listing across 11 western states, which was going to be huge. And we went to a sage grouse, a working group, a local working group conference put on by the Fed in Reno, of all these working groups across the West, hundreds of people, biologists, ranchers, people, you know, landowners that were going to be affected. And we ended up getting together with a group in Douglas County that was working on a multi-species habitat conservation plan. They had boatloads of data and no way to put it together. We said, well, we can put it together if you'll explain to us what all this stuff means. So we built for them a model of sage grouse, had sage grouse biology and land use. So we had wheatland and conservation reserve land that could change statuses. And that, I was hooked after that. And I also then worked on a project with University of British Columbia and Environment Canada on the Okanagan watershed in Canada, the whole watershed. And we did a large participatory modeling project with the provincial government, local water users, local water management groups, ag, and did a high-level model on the entire watershed with respect to population growth and climate change, where the area is growing exponentially. All growth is exponential, but it's very, very high growth. I think they're at 3 or 4%, which is huge for a small area. So they're trying to figure out how to manage their water resources, and they really need to go to provincial basin-wide planning instead of having 137 water districts making decisions independently.
Did they come to that conclusion?
They, at the end, again, this is a sort of a stepwise process, and getting these people together, they realize the value of looking at it this way. And hopefully the next step is that inspired discussion among these people to go to the next step and investigate then a large-scale planning process. So these things are stepwise in how you can sort of nudge people in that direction, but whether they choose to or not. I mean, it seems inevitable in this basin that we have to go to basin-wide planning. It seems inevitable up there, but when people aren't going to do it until they're willing.
So you're... studies got you back into it,
mm-hmm.
Got you into it, introduced you to these fun things, mm-hmm. and then you finished your PhD.
Finished my PhD and went directly to work for Waters of the West. So they, Barb Cousins had been on my committee and had followed this all along. And Fritz Fiedler got excited about system dynamics, actually separately, and thought, this is a great way to do this sort of thing, which a bunch of us who are into this participatory modeling have made the same connection sort of on our own and gone, this is a very interesting way of doing this. Why isn't everybody doing this? And then you start finding out there are a lot of people doing it. We're sort of a disjunct group that is trying actually to meet more often. And there's a bunch of us that communicate.
And I'm gonna make an analogy here and see what you think of this. I'm just reading a book where it's fiction, but they describe an African culture where the leaders don't decide on your leaders. You don't decide on anything by casting votes, yes, no, and half the people are unhappy or close to
right.
But you take much time and you get all these input and you come to some agreement that's pretty happy. Not so much compromise, but
consensus based,
right. More or less. It sounds like that's what you're doing in a way.
Well, that's what we strive for.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the direction, and I think there are win-wins to a lot of situations. If you get past people arguing personal values, left-wing, right-wing, you know, politics, get past all that, we share a resource. And how we manage it's going to affect all of us. And different people have different jobs. I mean, developers have jobs to do what they do. And what they develop, perhaps communities have more control over. Just like on a personal side here, I was asking somebody who was complaining about the Hawkins development. I said, how would you feel if that was a museum complex? Oh, that would be fine. I said, that has nothing to do with water. Museums and Lowe's probably use the same amount of water. What do they need? They need toilets and fire suppression. They all have impervious surfaces. They all have create traffic. And then it was sort of, oh. So I think the point is better design. I think growth is inevitable. Growth that degrades resources is just bad design. So I think that we can design things better. And for those that say it's too expensive, well, it depends on how you do your spreadsheet.
How many years out?
Right, and what you include. If you include cost of regulation, you know, cost of stormwater issues, I think there's, it all depends on how you'd run the spreadsheet.
Well, thanks very much. I really glad you could spend a little time as I caught you here.
Well, thank you.
Allison Beal is the lead facilitator and modeler for the University of Idaho Waters of the West, which is focused on the Palouse Basin Participatory Model Pilot Project. She helps focus members of the local aquifer committee and citizens advisory group to use participatory modeling for decision-making about aquifer management. Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio. Today's theme is More Water. Installment number 2 is in a round town in Moscow, Idaho, where Yin Radio's Anna Maria Roque asked people when they learned to swim.
In the summertime, water becomes more than a resource. It becomes a playing field for swimming, boating, rafting, kayaking, and tons of fun. All of these activities require one basic skill, swimming. I did an around town with the question, do you know how to swim? And here are the answers I got.
Do you know how to swim?
No.
No?
I doggy paddle.
Really?
Yeah.
Why didn't you ever learn?
I took swimming lessons when I was in kindergarten, and I was like a swimming school dropout. I couldn't do it, so I doggy paddle now. I mean, I don't think I'll die if I put in water. I'm not going to drown, but I can, like, I can float on my back and stuff. So no, can I still learn?
You're,
I don't know.
You're never too old to learn.
Never too old. Maybe. I don't know. It's never been an issue.
My mom put me in swimming lessons when I was early. I was like a little fish in water. I had a cute little pink swimsuit. And like, they have video, home videos of me, like jumping off the diving board and being like a little fish. Now I'm not really that into it. I mean, I know how, but I don't like go swimming for recreation.
Do you know how to swim?
I do. I started when I was 5 or 6 and kept taking swimming lessons until I was 12.
I do know how to swim. I learned when I was little, but I'm not very good at it.
Do you like it when you learned it?
Yeah. Except for the fact that I'm kind of really sensitive to chlorine, so that was entertaining.
Do you know how to swim?
No, not really.
You never learned?
Yeah, I learned, but I'm not that good at it. I could save my life, but I don't think I could do it competitively.
Do you know how to swim?
Yes, I do.
How well?
Well, let's see. When I was in third grade, I was on the swim team, Vista Diablo Dolphins in California, and that was a neighborhood, so everyone had to learn how to swim. But I was a really good swimmer at a young age, so I don't know. I can't remember learning how to swim. I've always swam, so got the bronze medal, actually.
Nice.
That's the lowest honor. Yeah, and then I was also on swim team when I moved back to Elko, Nevada. I was on swim team there, made it for a day, couldn't hack it. So, yeah, I also tried out for a lifeguard.
Well,
didn't make it. But I can still swim.
When did you learn to swim?
5 or 6 years old.
Yeah? How did you learn?
Took lessons.
You like them?
Yeah.
Do you swim a lot?
I used to swim a lot. Not anymore. Not for you. It's last time I was in the pool was in 2006 in California. But I don't swim a lot at W.C. or Pullman now.
Do you know how to swim?
Yeah.
When did you learn?
I think in first grade.
First grade? Did you like swimming?
Did I like swimming? It scared me. I didn't want to put my head under water. I used to cry.
Do you swim a lot?
In the summer. Not in the pool though. I like the river.
Poet Elizabeth Branfield uses swimming as a metaphor for love.
In this poem is called Endurance, and it's inspired by the long-distance swimmer Lynn Cox, but it really has not that much to do with her. It's called Endurance. There's a woman now swimming the English Channel or the Bering Sea or across some other impossible water between unimportant shores, miles of it. She sips from cups extended over the waves on a pole. She cannot hear voices and measures time in breaths. I'd love to see her entering the water, capped and suited, greased for the psychological edge of speed and warmth, and to save her skin from the pickling brine. I'd love to see her stumbling out on the other shore, knees unused to weight, buckling. Of course, this is how I see love. Something of endurance and unreasonable calm. Harder to attempt once you've known the numbing tiredness, the unrelenting salt, the safe boat unable to gather you up if you want the miles to count for anything, and you wade in anyway.
You're tuned to Yin Radio. Today's theme is More Water. Up next, Alison Crowe is a singer-songwriter and piano player from Canada. Here she is performing her song, Pray for Rain. It was recorded live at Wood Hall, a converted chapel of the Victoria, British Columbia's Conservatory of Music.
I don't
That's Alison Crowe. She makes her music available for free at alisoncrowe.com. That's AlisonCrowe.com. Installment number 3 in Yin Radio's first water show, Jessica Partnow, brought us a story of women walking to collect water in Ethiopia. Today she brings us another water story from Africa, where water woes do abound.
Chala Ahmed had a dream. He wanted to build a waterfront home for his family on the shores of Lake Haramaya in eastern Ethiopia. But now that's impossible. The lake has dried up. Lakes around the world are shrinking. Some attribute this to climate change. Others believe water mismanagement is at the root of the problem. Whatever the cause, the shrinking water supply is affecting communities all across the globe. Jessica Partnow brings us this story from Ethiopia.
Chala Ahmed should be standing under 25 feet of water. Instead, he's in the middle of a pale, grassy field.
I came out in here at night. In the morning, I just wake up the first time. Then I went outside and see, and then I start crying, you know.
Young children are herding sheep and goats around him as he shades his eyes from the afternoon sun. Ahmed had a dream to build a lakefront home for his family here. The 26-year-old has been working in Minnesota, driving a long-haul truck and saving up to build the house. This is his first visit home in 8 years.
Even right now, for me, when I walk on this lake, I mean, I get emotional, you know, when I remember every little thing I used to do in this lake, you know.
Friends had told him the lake was drying up, but it was hard to believe that a 9-mile stretch of water that had been there all his life could disappear.
It's sad. It's very sad. I never thought this lake was going to be gone because it was a natural thing, you know.
For Ahmed, the water's disappearance came as a sudden shock. But for people living around Lake Haramaya, as it shrank, it was a horrifying decades-long process. Lake Haramaya is a closed water catchment fed only by rainfall, and the amount of water taken out simply overwhelmed the amount going in. Here, farmers frantically dig deeper and deeper into the mud in search of water for their crops. There's still water under the ground here, and in the rainy season, a puddle sometimes forms in the center of the lake. But right now, still months away from rain, the farmers must dig up to 22 feet into the earth before they hit water. Ahmed Dawid's family has been farming the land around Lake Haramaya for generations.
We spend a week digging a well like this one. Then we can go work on our farms for 2 or 3 days.
Like Dawid, many farmers here grow chaat, a mild stimulant popular in the region. Over the past decade, farmers have used irrigation to push the thirsty, deep-rooted shrub to produce 3 or 4 harvests a year. In the dry season, a single kilo can bring 1,000 Ethiopian birr, or more than $100, 10 times the rainy season rate. Dawid says the economic incentive to irrigate is intense.
Now we put all our energy into digging for water. We don't have enough time to tend our crops. We can't grow as much as we used to.
Dawid can see the water he's pumping from the lake bed won't last long. He's sending his 4 children to school in hopes they'll find work other than farming. He laughs when I ask him what will happen when the water goes.
What can we do? We have to follow the will of God.
Farmers have been blamed for what happened to the lake, but others share in the responsibility. A brewery used lake water to make beer, and the city of Harar used Haramaya as its primary source of drinking water. Climate change has only made things worse. The past 2 decades have seen rising temperatures, which lead to more evaporation and increasingly erratic rains.
You know the level of the water.
Okay, it's like a big yardstick that goes up to the top.
This is simply indication of how much it is inside. Mm-hmm. So we do have 3.
Bushara Rashid is head of public relations for the Harar Water Supply. We're looking at the city's 20,000-gallon reservoir, a squat cylindrical tank sitting in the hollow of land that used to be the lake's northern curve. The water comes from boreholes dug into the former lake bed, powered uphill by a humming generator. The system was constructed once it became clear that the lake was going to dry up completely, but it wasn't finished in time.
During the emergency, no school. School was closed. Even there is no water for hand washing.
The emergency started on February 10, 2004, when the pumps bringing lake water to the city of Harar were turned off for the last time. International aid groups sent in water trucks to help the 91,000 who were left without running water. Before the crisis, Rashid had lobbied the government to restrict lake water usage, but the regional and national water ministries each claimed the other was responsible.
So during that emergency pledge, we voiced or screamed that, please declare state of emergency.
The town eventually connected its 100-year-old pipes to the hastily dug boreholes, bringing water back to the city. Hydrologists have warned this groundwater will only last a few years. So next year, the town of Harar hopes to bring a new system online, which will pump groundwater from 30 miles away. It's estimated that water source will last 3 decades at the most. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow in Haramaya, Ethiopia.
That was Jessica Partnow. She works for the multimedia collective, the Common Language Project in Seattle. Funding for the story was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. You can hear more at clpmag.org/East Africa. And I'm sharing the final installment on today's Water Stories show from my own experience. I call it Music and Waterworks. Installment number 4 and last for today. The first time it happened, I was in Boise. I had only arrived in Idaho 2 months before from Florida to start my new job at the University of Idaho as a fundraiser for the College of Engineering. In my early 30s, I was launching into my professional career and feeling strong, independent, capable, confident. It was a time of true happiness, the deep kind of rooted contentment that comes when you're living in the moment and drinking in each new sight and sound. It was my first time in Boise, and after some meetings and events that ran well into Friday night, I found myself with free time on a Saturday morning. I left my downtown hotel to walk in the brisk November air. I inhaled it deeply with a traveler's appreciation for new discoveries just around the corner. But before I even rounded the corner, I heard sounds of music, drums, outside, and trumpets, a marching band. My heart quickened and my throat tightened, and I practically skipped toward the growing noise. More cars, a few people, and then I was there, on the parade route. I started crying as I saw the band and I felt its beat in my chest. The lump that I had earlier in my throat had been a dam that burst and left me wanting to sob. So powerful was the reaction. 14 years later, I still have physical memory of that day. Each time I think about it, my body reacts and I'm exhilarated. My eyes fill with tears and my throat aches. It felt glorious and embarrassing, shocking. Ever since then, I've cried when a marching band comes by in a parade. I can hold the sobs back, but not the bursting heart feeling and the tears which leak out as I smile at the players, trying to keep up with them so that it can last as long as possible. I don't understand my body's reaction to the band, so seemingly opposed to my feelings of elation. But my associations and my childhood memories are clear. When I was a kid of 14, I would ride my bike beyond the little kid boundaries of my neighborhood, across Jackson Bluff Road and Lake Bradford Road. It was probably less than a mile, but it was new to be able to cross those wide roads that divided my access like a river. I crossed Gaines Street and entered a separate world that I could hear from my house when the wind was right and the band played or the crowd roared. It was Doak Campbell Stadium, home of the Florida State Seminoles. At 14, I was old enough, or unnoticed enough, to venture there and be anonymous among the college kids. On one occasion, I followed my ears, just as I would do years later in Boise, to the band. the Florida State Marching Band as it practiced. They practiced in a field near the stadium, with no bleachers to block the view of a neighborhood kid that was passing by. I stopped and got off my bike and listened with a heart full to the unforeseen and happy discovery of this big, marvelous music that was made just for me. Elated by discovery and unbound by the limits of roads and youth, my chest filled. New to self-awareness, I was, however, aware of my independence and my aloneness and my freedom. Perhaps that's what I'm going to feel tomorrow. For as I write this, I'm well aware that in the morning I'll go downtown to the biggest parade Moscow hosts each year, the University of Idaho's Homecoming Parade. Every year, high schools send bands from all over the state. Even some junior highs come. One of those junior highs has a jazz band that shocks you with their skill. And they all march, one by one, a Greek float or two in between, some politicians walking by, and I cry, and I walk along the parade route with any of the bands that I especially like, blubbering quietly. I avoid the eyes of people lining the street so I can avoid being swept into conversations. After 14 years in a small town, it's impossible to be anonymous after all. So I avoid their eyes, or act like I'm rushing to meet someone and let myself be swept instead along with the bands, rushing to keep up with a favorite, red-faced and hiding my eyes, and then turning and heading back upstream to catch another band. Always moving, always crying lightly. When I finally leave Main Street, I round the corner just ahead of the crowd so I can really let it go. And then I bawl, deep-rooted sobs coming from a still unknown deep place in my soul as I hear the sound of the last band fade in the distance. Since I wrote that piece, just last night, the parade has passed by, just a few hours ago, and the elation still remains. Thank you. And this is wrapping up our More Water show for this Yin Radio program. We're listening to Cirrus Almonde with Is It Raining Again? You can contact Yin Radio at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Y-I-N Radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. You can find our podcast, this and past shows, at yinradio.org on the web. I'd like to thank Patricia Kempthorne, Allison Beale, Anna Maria Roque, Jessica Partnow, Elizabeth Branfield for today's show. All pieces for today's show were produced by Sandy Billings, with the exception of the Around Town segment, which was produced by Anna Maria Roque. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.